Although there was a Negroponte Avenue, which Aisha suspected might be racist, but the whole area had always been called the Black and Blue. Much as it had never occurred to her to find out why Coulson didn't live with his own mother, she'd never thought to ask anyone why she lived in a part of town that sounded like a beating instead of a neighborhood. Mission Avenue was four lanes wide where it intersected with Copper. A big strip mall, the Coastal Mercantile, ran for a few blocks along the far side of the road. The lot was desolate, only a handful of cars parked there. The night was warm, almost hot, perfumed with exhaust from the passing traffic. A police cruiser flew past, blowing through a yellow light just as it turned red, the darkness stuttering with blinding blue flashes.
And I said over in England, pants mean underwear, and Cheryl said English people ought to use the right words for things, and I said if they use the wrong words, how come we go to school to study English instead of American?
Aisha was especially proud of this riposte, which she felt had properly put Cheryl Portis in her place at the end of a long, wearying argument about whether or not British accents were real or just faked for movies.
"Mm-hmm," Coulson said, waiting for the walk light. At some point he had wrestled her backpack away from her and slung it over his own shoulder.
Oh, that reminds me, Cole.
"Mm-hmm."
How long are you going to live in England?
Aisha had England on the brain, had been thinking about the place all week, ever since she heard that Coulson had sent an application to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. He hadn't heard back yet, wouldn't hear back until spring. But he hadn't bothered applying anywhere else, acted like he'd already been accepted, or at least wasn't worried about being turned down.
I don't know. However long it takes to meet Jane Seymour.
Who's Jane Seymour?
She's Dr. Quinn, medicine woman. She's also going to be my first wife, first of many.
Doesn't she live out west? That's where the show is set.
No, she's from London.
What will you do if she doesn't want to marry you?
Pour my sadness into my art. It'd be tough if she didn't want me. But I'd just take all that heartache and use it to be the best Hamlet ever stalked the boards.
Is Hamlet black?
He is if I'm playing him. Come on, we're going to run for it. I think the walk light is busted.
They waited for an opening and beat feet across Mission, holding hands. As they slowed and stepped up onto the curb on the far side, they heard the ugly squall of a police siren and another cruiser slammed past. Aisha started singing the reggae song that began every episode of Cops, hardly aware she was doing it. It was not at all uncommon for the police to kick up a racket this time of the night, booming along the streets with their disco lights pulsing and their sirens scaring the bejesus out of people. You never knew why or even wondered. It was like the hum of crickets, just another night sound. As it happened, the police were crisscrossing the Black and Blue looking for a stolen Miata. 40 minutes before, out on the north edge of St. Pocenti, where there were mansions with stucco walls and roofs of red Spanish tile, a couple had been followed into their house by a man in fatigues, wearing a woman's stocking over his face. William Berry had been stabbed twice in the abdomen. His wife had been stabbed 19 times in the back as she tried to run away. The assailant then calmly helped himself to her purple Hermes purse, the jewelry in the bedroom, their DVD player, and some admittedly pornographic DVDs. The man with the knife whistled while he took what he wanted and occasionally chatted to Bill Berry while the 42-year-old investment banker lay on the floor groaning. He complimented them on their interior decoration and particularly admired their drapes. He promised he would pray for both of them to recover. Kathy Berry did not, but Bill Berry was expected to survive, although he was in intensive care with a perforated large intestine. Bill had been coherent enough to report that the killer sounded black and smelled of alcohol. The Miata had been spotted by a crossing guard entering the Black and Blue not 20 minutes before. The lot spread out around Coastal Mercantile was pitched and cracked, the fissures badly sealed with scribbles of tar. The strip mall housed a check cashing joint, open, a liquor store, open, a tobacconist's, open, a dentist's office, closed, a Baptist church called the Holy Renewal Experience, closed, a jobs office called Work Now Staffing, permanently closed, and a coin-op laundromat that was open now, would be open at 3 a.m., and would probably continue to offer the use of its overpriced, underpowered washers and dryers right through the rapture. Coulson slowed alongside an Econoline van with a desert scene painted on it, and tugged on the handle of the driver's side door. Locked.
"What are you doing?"
Aisha asked.
"This looks like the kind of van kidnappers drive," Coulson said. "I want to make sure there isn't a girl tied up in the back."
Aisha cupped her hands around her face and pressed her nose to the tinted bubble window. She didn't see anyone tied up. Satisfied that the van was locked and empty, they walked on. Soon they would pass around the corner of the building, down along one side of the mercantile, over a fence, and into the tangles, 4 acres of buttonwood, cabbage palms, anthills, and beer bottles. Coulson slowed again as they passed a blue Miata. Too nice for coastal mercantile, black leather interior, glossy cherry dash. He tugged on the latch.
"Why'd you do that?"
"Had to make sure the lady locked her doors. Anyone who'd park a car like this in a black and blue don't have the sense to look after their stuff."
Aisha wished Coulson would stop yanking on door handles. He didn't worry about getting in trouble, so she had to worry for him.
"How do you know it's a lady's car?"
"'Cause a Miata look more like a lipstick than a car. They won't even sell you a car like this if you're a man, unless you turn your balls in first."
They walked on.
"So, after you marry Jane Seymour, when are you going to come back to Florida so I can meet her?"
"You'll come to me. Come to London. You can study dance, same place I'm going to study being famous."
"You're studying acting."
"Same thing."
"Are you going to get a British accent while you're there?"
"You bet. Pick one up in the gift shop at Buckingham Palace first day I'm there," he said, but in a distant, disinterested voice.
They were passing a battered Alfa Romeo, the driver's side door painted an ashy matte black, the rest of the car the too bright yellow of Gatorade. CDs were scattered across the dashboard, a collection of reflective silver frisbees. When Coulson tested the driver's side door, it sprang open, one Romeo welcoming another.
"Oh, look it," he said. "Someone has not been putting safety first."
Aisha kept walking, willing Coulson to come with her. When she'd gone 5 steps, she dared to look around. Coulson remained back by the Alfa Romeo, ducked down and leaning inside, a sight that gave her an ill feeling.
"Coulson?"
she asked. She meant to shout it, to say it like a scold. Aisha had a fine voice for scolding, but it came out in an unhappy waver. He straightened up, looked back at her with blank eyes. He had her purple backpack balanced on his knee, half unzipped, and was rooting around inside.
"Coulson, come on," she said.
"Just a minute."
He dug a spiral-bound notebook out of the backpack, felt inside for a pencil. He tore a sheet out, spread it on the roof, and began to write.
"We got to do an important public service here."
Aisha cast a glance at the strip mall. They were parallel with the coin-op, the brightest storefront in the whole row. The door was propped open with a cinder block, and they were close enough that she could hear the sound of tumbling dryers. She was sure at any moment someone would appear in the doorway and yell. She crept toward him. She wanted to grab his hand and pull him along, but when she got close enough to take his sleeve, he yanked his arm free and kept writing. As he scribbled away, he began to read.
"Dear sir, it has come to our attention that you neglected to lock the doors of your mint-condition Alfa Romeo this evening. We have taken the liberty of locking the doors for you. Please be aware that this neighborhood is full of smelly, ungroomed hobos who might have used your vehicle for a toilet. If you are not currently sitting in a puddle of stanky wino piss, you can thank the Promoters of Normal Urination team. Support your local Pee on You squad today.
In spite of herself, Aisha laughed. Coulson drifted from one moment that belonged in a play to another, with a serene, spacey calm that approached indifference. He folded the letter and placed it on the dash. When he drew his arm back, the sleeve of his denim jacket caught a CD and knocked it to the floor. He picked it up, considered it, then set it on the roof of the car. He grabbed up his note and began to write again.
P.S., he said. We have taken the further step of absconding with your copy of Pocketful of Kryptonite to protect you from the spin doctors.
Coulson?
Aisha cried out, heartsick to go.
Who can be harmful to your hearing? Please replace with Public Enemy and treat yourself with daily doses until you are less of a lame ass.
Coulson!
She shouted again, almost screamed. It wasn't funny anymore. It had never been really funny, even if he'd tricked a giggle out of her. He slammed the door and wandered on, her backpack hitched over his shoulder. He had a finger through the hole in the center of the CD. Rainbows shimmied across the surface. He went 3 yards, then paused to look back with a certain impatience.
We going or not? Don't yell at me to hurry up, then stand there like you can't remember how to move your feet.
When she began to run after him, he turned and walked on. Aisha chased him down, grabbed his wrist, set her heels, and pulled.
Put it back.
He stopped, looked at the CD on his finger, then over at Aisha's hands on his right wrist.
Nah.
He walked on, mostly dragging her.
Put it back.
Can't. This is my good deed for the day. I just rescued someone's ears.
Put it back.
Can't. I locked the door so no one steals something actually worth stealing, like the gold St. Christopher medal hanging from the rearview mirror. Come on now, quit it. You're ruining my buzz.
She knew why he took it. Not because he was a thief, but because it was funny, or would be funny, when he told his friends. When he told them about Pee on You, the CD was his proof it wasn't just a story. Coulson needed stories to tell like a gun needed bullets, and for the same reason. To slay. But Aisha also knew about fingerprints, and felt it was only a matter of time before the police dropped in to arrest him for grand theft spin doctors. And he wouldn't get to go to London and be Hamlet, and his life would be ruined, and hers, too. He grasped her hand, and on they went, around the corner, along a buckled side road in even worse condition than the main parking lot. He led her to the back corner of the lot and into the weeds, to a sagging chain-link fence, half-smothered by the high grass and undergrowth. By then, she was weeping steadily and silently, drawing deep, shaking breaths. Coulson bent to help her up onto the fence, and seemed genuinely shocked to see the tears dripping off her chin.
Hey, what's going on, Twinkle Toes?
You should put it back.
She shouted in his face, hardly aware of how loud she was being. He bent backward like a bush in a gale, and opened his eyes wide.
Whoa, Godzilla! I can't, told you. I locked the dude's car.
She opened her mouth to shout something else, and sobbed instead. He caught her shoulder and held her while she shook and made big racking sounds of misery. He used his tea to wipe her face. When her vision came unblurred, she could see him smiling with a kind of bewilderment. All you had to do was see him smile to understand why Juliet would die for him.
No one cares about a spin doctor's CD,
he said, but she already knew she had won and was able to catch her breath, hold her next sob in.
Damn, girl, You're going to ruin a perfectly good joke, you know that? You're like the joke police. Going to write me a ticket for being flagrantly amusing? How about I go back and put the CD on the roof of the car? Will that make it better?
She nodded, didn't trust her voice. She told him she was glad by hugging him instead, throwing her wiry 9-year-old arms around his neck. For years afterwards, she could close her eyes and bring it back, exactly what that hug had felt like, the way he laughed, one hand between her shoulder blades, the way he hugged her goodbye. He rose, turned her toward the fence. Her fingers found the chain links. He scooped one hand onto her butt to help her over the top, and she dropped down onto the other side, into the thick brush.
"Wait for me," he said, and slapped the fence.
He went, still unconsciously carrying her Little Mermaid backpack over one shoulder, the CD hanging off the index finger of his right hand. The disc flashed silver in the darkness, as bright as Romeo's bodkin. In a moment he had disappeared around the corner. Aisha waited in the velvety darkness, a night orchestra of insects playing their sleepy lullaby in the undergrowth. When Coulson came back, it was at a trot that accelerated to a sprint when someone yelled. He'd been gone only a few seconds, half a minute at most. He darted along the shattered side road, head down, backpack slapping against his shoulder. A man came running after him, a man in a heavy belt, with things rattling and jangling on it. The night lit up in a flurry of silver and blue lights, flashing like a simulated thunderstorm in a theater. The man in the belt was slow, panting for breath.
"Put it the fuck down!"
screamed the man in the jangling belt, a police officer, a white kid, Aisha saw now, not much older than Coulson himself.
"Drop it! Drop it!"
Coulson hit the fence with a steely crash, hit it so hard that Aisha unconsciously staggered even farther back into the gloom of the thicket. Coulson went halfway up, and then snagged in place. The Little Mermaid backpack. Later, Officer Reb Mooney would state that he had believed it was the Hermes purse stolen from the scene of the stabbing earlier that evening, had dropped off Coulson's shoulder as he ran, and by the time he slammed into the fence, he was holding it by just one strap. A bent hook of old steel at the bottom of the fence snared the fabric, and as Coulson climbed, the backpack was yanked out of his hand. Coulson glared down at it and grimaced, considered it for an instant, then dropped back down. He sank to one knee to collect Aisha's backpack out of the dirt. The police officer came to a stumbling stop 8 feet away. That was the first Aisha saw the gun in his right hand. Mooney, a big freckled boy who planned to marry his high school sweetheart in just 2 weeks, gasped for breath, red in the face. A cruiser rolled into view, coming around the corner of the mercantile, lights flashing.
"Down on the ground!"
Mooney screamed, coming closer, lifting the gun.
"Hands in the air!"
Coulson looked up and began to raise his hands. He still had the CD ridiculously stuck to the end of one finger. The kid cop put his boot on Coulson's shoulder and shoved. Coulson hit the fence, grunted, and rebounded. He bounced off the fence so hard, he almost seemed to lunge at the officer. The CD flashed in his hand. The gun went off. The first bullet pounded Coulson Withers into the fence once more. Mooney fired 6 times in all. The last 3 rounds went into Coulson's back, after he had sprawled onto his face. Later, both Mooney and his partner, Paul Haddonfield, told the grand jury they'd believed the CD was a knife. In the aftermath, the night ringing with the echoes of those shots, neither officer heard Aisha Lanternglass fleeing into the tangles. The following summer, the St. Pocenti Players would dedicate that year's performance of Shakespeare in the Park to Coulson's memory. It was Hamlet. A white guy starred. September 2012, December 2012. Becky and Raj always met at the gun range. First, they'd unload a few hundred rounds, then he'd unload into her in his cherry Lambo. The very first time they went shooting together, they took turns with his Glock, emptying the 33-round magazine into a human silhouette.
"God damn," Becky said. "Is a clip that big even legal in this state?"
"Honey," Raj told her, "this is Florida. I don't know if you're legal, but the mag is fine." Like she was still in high school and not taking college courses in business management. He stood behind her, his crotch pressing against her backside and his arms reaching around her. He smelled good, like lemons and sandalwood and the sea. And when he held her, she thought of yachts and gem-bright waters. She wanted to dive for treasure with him and soak the Atlantic off him afterward in a hot shower. "One hand cups the other," he told her. "Press your thumbs together, keep your feet apart. Just like that, no? Not that wide."
"I'm already wet,"
she whispered to him. She pumped 33 bullets into the target, pretending it was his wife's big fake tits. Afterward, her whole body hummed in a nice, post-orgasmic kind of way. It was always foreplay for them. She had met Roger Lewis for the first time when she was 16. Her father had brought her to the mall, to Devotion Diamonds, so she could pick out a gold padlock on a gold chain, a gift for her to wear to her chastity pledge at church that Sunday. Raj helped her try a couple things on, and she turned this way and that in front of a little mirror on the glass counter, admiring the sparkle around her neck.
"You look good," Raj said. "Unblemished."
"Unblemished,"
she repeated. It was a curiously entrancing word.
"We're hiring sales girls this summer. If you sold a friend a padlock like the one you're wearing now, you'd get 10% of the price on top of your paycheck."
Becky looked at the price tag on the gold chain and let the heavy weight of the lock fall back against her breastbone. 10% of what she was wearing was more than she made in a whole week of packing bags at Walmart. She wore her padlock out of the store and had an application folded into her clutch. That Sunday she swore to her parents, her grandparents, her little sisters, and her entire church that there wasn't going to be any man in her life until marriage, except her father and Jesus. Becky was still wearing her padlock the first time Raj rubbed her off through her panties in the office in the back of the shop. By then she was out of high school and making almost $500 a month in commissions alone. The first few times they went to the range together, they stuck with the Glock. She pulled her hair back in a do-rag to keep it out of her face and to feel more street. Raj was okay with that. But the first time she tried to shoot like a gangster, the gun turned sideways, arm stretched out and wrist bent downward slightly, like she'd seen the bangers do in movies. He let her squeeze off only a single round before he reached in and took her forearm. He forced her to point the barrel at the floor.
"What's that shit? You've emptied a few mags at the range, so now you think you're Ice Cube? You couldn't be more white if you were shoved down and drowned in a vat of cream cheese. Don't do that again. I don't want anyone here seeing you shoot that way. It'll make me look bad."
So she shot the way he told her. Feet slightly apart, one a bit forward, the other a bit back, arms outstretched but not fully extended. Becky aimed for the center mass because Raj told her, if you hit the chest, you were going to get something juicy. Pretty soon she was bunching her shots together from 30 feet, grouping them in the area of the heart. After that he switched things up, met her at the range with his SCAR 7.62mm, loaded with 149 grain full metal jacket rounds. She pumped them out in bursts. Bap, bap, bap. Bap, bap, bap. Becky liked the smell of the propellant even better than Roger's cologne. Liked to smell gun smoke in his clothes, in his thinning blonde hair.
"It looks like a machine gun," she said.
"It is," he said, and took it out of her hands and swiveled a selector switch. He fitted the extended stock into his left shoulder and narrowed his eyes and pulled the trigger, and it went off in a furious, thudding clatter that made Becky think of someone hammering fiercely at an old manual typewriter. He cut the silhouette in half. She was so eager to shoot it herself that she almost snatched it out of his hands. Becky didn't know why anyone had to have cocaine when you could just get a gun.
"Don't you need a special license to blaze away with an automatic weapon?"
she asked him. "All you need is ammunition and a reason," he said. "You might want a license. I don't know. I've never looked into it." He was vain about his hair, was always patting it to make sure the thin yellow swirl covered his bald spot. He had deep creases at the corners of his eyes, but his body was as pink and clean as a boy's, fine golden hairs spun on his chest. She liked to play with that fine down, was pleased by the silky feel of it. Silk and gold always came to mind when he was stretched out naked beside her. Silk and gold and lead. 10 days before Christmas, she climbed into the Lambo after work, believing he was going to drive her to the range. Instead, he drove her to the Coconut Milk Bar and Inn, 20 miles south of St. Vicente. They had a suite on the first floor under the names Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker, which she sensed was one of Roger's jokes. She was well practiced at smiling blandly and indulgently to keep him from realizing she didn't get the reference. His conversation was sprinkled with lines from movies and music she knew nothing about, Dirty Harry and Nirvana and MTV's The Real World, old stuff like that, not even worth Googling. He carried a black Teflon bag with him, the handles padlocked together. She'd seen him move jewelry in that kind of bag, but didn't ask questions. The old woman behind the counter looked from Becky to Raj and back, and made a face like she had a bad taste in her mouth. Becky met her bitchy stare with calm indifference. "Isn't it a school night?" the clerk asked when she pushed their key across the counter. Becky took Roger's arm.
"I think it's so great that places like this hire old folks to give them something to do besides play bingo in a senior center somewhere."
Raj laughed his hoarse smoker's laugh and swatted Becky on the rear. To the old woman with the tinted orange hair, he said, "You're lucky she didn't bite. She ain't had her shots. You don't know what you might catch." Becky chomped her teeth together at the offended old bitch behind the register. Raj took her by the elbow and steered her down a corridor with thick white carpet that looked like it had never been walked on. He led her past brick arches that opened onto an outdoor patio, built around 3 swimming pools, each on a different terrace, waterfalls splashing between them. Couples sat on wicker chairs flanked by tall patio heaters, columns of caged fire. The palm trees had been done up for the holiday. The fronds hung with emerald Christmas lights, so they looked like fireworks frozen forever in spectacular mid-explosion. Becky shut her eyes to better hear the sound of ice clinking in glasses. You didn't need to drink to get drunk. That sound alone made her feel intoxicated. She didn't look around until he stopped at the door to their suite. The sheets were slippery silk, or something like silk, the color of vanilla frosting. The bathtub in the enormous bathroom had been hewn out of a hunk of lava rock. He put the chain on the door while she sat on the edge of the king mattress. He carried his bag to the bed.
"This is just for tonight. Everything goes back tomorrow morning."
He popped the lock, unclasped the wire jaws of the bag, and poured out a heap of treasure, gold hoops and freshwater pearls on silver ropes, bracelets crusted with diamonds, and necklaces hung with brilliant stones. It was as if he had dumped a bag full of light onto the opalescent sheets. There was white powder, too, in a crystal bottle like one you might fill with perfume. It might almost have been crushed diamonds. Raj had taught her to like a little coke before sex. It made her feel good and dirty, made her feel like a degenerate aiming to do something criminal. She was almost breathless at the sight of all those gems, all those shining threads.
"How much?" she asked.
"About $500,000. Go on, wear it. Put on all of it. I want to see you chained in it, like a sultan's concubine, like I bought you with all this.
Raj used words better than anyone Becky knew. Sometimes he sounded like a lover in an old movie, tossing off poetic dialogue in a clipped indifferent way, as if it were the most ordinary thing to talk like that. Amid the pile of treasure was a bra and panty set, gold straps speckled with rhinestones. There was also a long box wrapped in metallic gold paper, bound in a silver ribbon.
"The loot has to go back to the shop tomorrow morning," he said, and pushed the gift box toward her. "But this is yours to keep."
She grasped the wide, slippery package. Becky loved presents. She wished Christmas came every month.
"What's this?"
"A girl doesn't wear that much bling," Raj told her, "unless she knows she can keep it."
She tore away the paper and ribbon and tugged open the box. It was a 357 Smith & Wesson with a satin-white grip that looked like pearl, the stainless steel finish of the barrel engraved with fleur-de-lis and curlicues of ivy. He tossed something at her, a web of black leather straps and buckles, and for an instant she wondered if they were moving in a bondage direction that evening.
"That goes on your leg," he said. "If you wear the gun on the inside of your thigh, you could walk around in a pencil skirt and no one would know you're armed. I'm going to shower off. You?"
"Maybe later," she said, standing up and rising onto her toes to kiss him.
She bit his lower lip, and he took the front of her tight black slacks and pulled her against him. He was playing it cool, but he was already hard, poking her through his khakis. The shower was blasting for 15 minutes. Time enough to drop her clothes and drape herself in a small fortune. The gun went on last. She liked the way the leather straps cinched around the high part of her thigh, liked the silver buckles and the black lines against her skin. She knelt on the bed in chains, diamonds sparkling between her breasts, a silver choker around her throat, and practiced aiming at herself in the mirror. She was waiting when he came out in a towel, his chest glittering with beads of water. She lifted the gun in both hands.
"Drop that towel," she said, "and do exactly what I say if you want to live." "Point it somewhere else," he said. She pouted. "It isn't loaded." "That's what everyone thinks, right up to the moment someone's cock gets blown off."
She opened the cylinder and spun it, clickety-click, so he could see for himself it was empty. Then she slapped the cylinder back into the gun and pointed at him again.
"Get naked," she said.
He still didn't like her aiming the S&W at him. She could tell. But the sight of her breasts decorated with blazing diamonds was getting to him. He dropped the towel, his skinny cock bobbing in front of him, a sight both hilarious and thrilling, and crawled across the bed toward her. He kissed her, his tongue tasting her upper lip, and she was conscious of her composure and personhood sliding away in a familiar rush of want. He pulled her down on the bed using the gold chain and a fistful of her own hair, forcefully but not too rough. She managed to get the gun into the holster just before he pushed open her legs with one knee. She must have strapped the S&W on too loosely. His thigh forced the butt of the gun back against her crotch. Truth was, she never came harder than in those first few minutes when he was kissing her, and her clit was grinding against the soft, hard rubber of the 357's pearly grip. She went off like a pistol. The actual sex was just the recoil.
April 12, 2013. At the end of his shift, Randall Kellaway let himself into the security office and found a sheriff's deputy waiting for him, a grinning Latina in one of those ugly Hillary Clinton pantsuits, a Glock on her massive hip. You never saw white cops anymore. It was all about increasing diversity now. After Iraq, Kellaway had applied to the state police, the local police, the sheriff's office, and the FBI, and never so much as got an interview. State cops said he was too old.
Sheriff's office wouldn't hire him because he'd been adcept. The feds told him there were suitability issues after he took their psych test. The local cops didn't have any openings and reminded him he had $900 in unpaid speeding tickets. What it came down to, a black guy who talked in Ebonics could get hired if he had just managed to graduate high school without murdering someone in a drive-by. A white guy had to have matriculated at Yale and volunteered to work with orphans who had AIDS to even get a foot in the door. When Kellaway entered the security office, he was on the customer side of the desk with Officer Chiquita Banana. The receptionist, Joni, was on the other side of the plexiglass window, sitting in her rickety rolling office chair. There was one other security guard there, too, Eddie Dowling, taking off his belt and hanging it up in his locker. It was just like Ed to decide to call it a night 10 minutes before quitting time.
"Here he is, Officer Acosta. I told you, he doesn't clock out until the minute his shift ends. Mr. Kellaway is very punctual. Randy, this is Officer Acosta from the Sheriff's Department."
"I know where she's from, Joan. I recognize the uniform."
Folks from the police department and the sheriff's office dropped in all the time. In January, it had been to show him the mugshot of a wanted felon who was engaged to a girl who worked in the food court. In March, it had been to warn him there was a known pedophile just down the road and to keep an eye out for him. He was thinking it might be something about the black kid who had just started working at Boost Your Game. A week ago, Kellaway had found him carrying boxes out the Boost Your Game service door and loading them into a rusty, rinky-dink Ford Fiesta. Kellaway had told him to get against the car and put his hands on the roof. Had thought the kid was boosting his game by boosting some shoes. It was an hour before opening and the boy wasn't in uniform, and Kellaway had never seen his face, didn't know he was a new hire, didn't know the kid had been instructed to drive some fancy Nikes to the Boost Your Game outlet in Daytona Beach. Naturally, now it looked like Kellaway was a racist and not a guy who'd made an honest mistake. If it really had been a mistake. Kid had a bumper sticker said, "Legalize gay marijuana," which was pretty much a raised middle finger to a world where rules mattered. Kellaway could hope that Acosta had come to tell him the kid was a known banger and she wanted to search his Fiesta for crack and guns. And why, he wondered, did the most American of American car companies name one of their vehicles a Fiesta, which sounded more like a bargain meal at Taco Bell? Although probably the plant making those cars was in Tijuana, so the name actually suited. Just before Acosta spoke, though, Kellaway noticed a wan look on Ed Dowling's face. He saw, too, that Joni was willfully not looking at him, pretending to be interested in something on the screen of her antique Dell. Joni, who inserted herself in the middle of every conversation and couldn't bear to let any visitors to the office escape without forcing them to answer a dozen mindless questions about what they did, where they came from, and if they had seen last week's Dr. Phil. Kellaway felt the briefest of misgivings, a kind of grim flicker, the psychological equivalent of dull, distant heat lightning.
"Let's have it," he said.
"You got it, darling," said Acosta, and she slapped some folded papers into his hands.
His gaze skipped across the blocks of text. Temporary injunction for protection against domestic violence and notice of hearing and scheduled to appear and testify.
"You are instructed by the state of Florida not to physically approach Holly Kellaway? Either at her current place of residence at 1419 Tortola Way, or at her place of employment with the Tropic Lights Cable Network at 5040 Kitts Avenue, or to approach her son, our son, George Kellaway, at the Bushwick Montessori on Topaz Avenue. If you are found within 500 feet of their place of residence, her place of employment, or your son's school, you will be subject to arrest for violating this restraining order. Are we clear?"
"On what grounds?"
"You'll have to ask the judge at the hearing, the date of which..."
"I'm asking you. On what grounds can the state of Florida decide to keep me away from my own child?"
Do you really want to do this in front of your co-workers, Mr. Kellaway? She said,
I never put a hand on the hysterical bitch, or the boy either. If she says anything else, it's lies.
Acosta said, Did you ever point a gun at her, Mr. Kellaway? He didn't reply. Joni exhaled a snorting breath like a tired horse and began typing furiously, her eyes fixed on the screen of her computer.
You're going to want to call her, Acosta said.
Don't. You are forbidden to contact her directly. You want to say something to her? Get a lawyer. Have him say it. You're going to want a lawyer for the hearing anyway.
So, if I call to say good night to my 6-year-old, someone's going to arrest me? Should I hire a lawyer to call on a nightly basis to read bedtime stories to him?
Acosta went on as if he hadn't spoken.
You have been scheduled for a hearing. The date and time is in the injunction. If you do not appear at the hearing, you can expect the restraining order to be continued in force indefinitely.
You may attend the hearing with your legal counsel, or you may be a dumbass. It's up to you. Now, you've been eating frozen dinners ever since your wife moved out, and you may be getting tired of them. Let me tell you, they're better than what's on the menu in the county jail. Take my advice, and don't put eyes on your ex until you see her at the hearing. Got me?
He felt sick. He felt like taking his chrome-handled flashlight to her fat, dykey face. She had a dyke haircut. Could have been in the Marines with a haircut like that.
That it? We done?
Nope. He didn't like the way she said it. Didn't like how happy she sounded.
What else?
Do you have any guns here or in your car?
The fuck that matter?
You are instructed by the order of the state of Florida to turn in your firearms to the sheriff's department until the judge concludes it is safe for you to possess them.
I am a security guard, he said.
Do mall cops pack? Your co-worker wasn't carrying when he walked in. When Kellaway didn't answer, Acosta looked through the window at Joni and Ed. Are you required to carry while you're on the job? A strained quiet settled upon the room. The vending machine kicked on, a soft whoomp and a hum.
No, ma'am,
Eddie Dowling said at last, grimacing and glancing apologetically at Kellaway. Are you even allowed to carry a gun? She asked.
Not in your first year, ma'am, said Ed. But after that, if you wear it discreetly, it's not prohibited, ma'am.
Right. She said and looked back at Kellaway. Are you packing now? Kellaway could feel a vein throbbing in the center of his forehead. She inspected him, glanced at his belt, nothing attached to it except his walkie-talkie and his flashlight, then down along the length of his body and back up.
What's that on your ankle? She asked.
That the Colt Python or the SIG?
How do you...
He started, then clenched his teeth together. Holly. The silly, fragile bitch had given the sheriff's department a list of all his guns.
Mr. Kellaway, would you please surrender your weapon? I'll be glad to give you a receipt for it.
For a long time he just glared at her, and she smiled pleasantly back at him. Finally he put his foot up on the mustard-colored love seat against the wall, the one with the patched cushions, and yanked up his pant leg.
Like anyone could carry a fucking Colt Python in an ankle holster. You ever seen a Colt Python?
He said, unbuckling the entire holster and wiggling it loose and pulling it off.
It would be a pain in the ass with a full-size python, but it's doable if it's the snub.
Your ex wasn't sure which you owned. He gave her the SIG. She briskly removed the mag, pumped the slide, and squinted into the chamber to make sure it was unloaded. When she was sure it was safe, she zipped it into a big clear plastic bag and put it aside on the Formica counter. She rummaged in her leather satchel, came up with a slip of paper, and squinted down at it.
So, is the Colt in your locker? You got a warrant to find out?
I don't need one. Not for that. I have permission from Russ Dorr, the CEO of Sunbelt Marketplace, the firm that owns this mall. You can call him yourself and ask if you're wondering. Your locker isn't your locker. It's his.
What are you going to do if it's not there? Follow me to my house? Better have a warrant for that.
We don't need to go to your house, Mr. Kellaway. We've already been there. Your wife gave us a key and granted us permission to enter the premises, as is her right. She's co-listed on the mortgage. But we didn't find the cult or the SIG. She scanned the sheet of paper.
Or the Uzi.
Really?
An Uzi?
That's some real Rambo shit, Mr. Kellaway. For your sake, I hope it hasn't been converted.
It's a legacy piece, he said. From 1984, grandfathered in. If your boys looked in my file cabinet, they would have found all the paperwork on it. It's legal.
That must have cost some money. I guess patrolling them all pays good. That right? You get top dollar making sure no one snatches a Cinnabon and runs for the doors? He opened his locker and got the Colt and handed it to her butt first, the cylinder open. She shook the bullets out into the cup of her palm, spun the cylinder, and snapped it back into the frame with an agile flick of her wrist. It went into the plastic bag with the SIG. Acosta wrote him a receipt in a notepad that resembled what a waitress would use to take an order. That was what Acosta should have been doing, copying down orders in a Waffle House somewhere.
The Uzi in the car? She asked.
He was going to ask if she had a warrant, but as he opened his mouth, her gaze swept up and met his, and she looked at him with a benign calm he could hardly stand. Of course she had one. She was waiting for him to ask so she could show him up, humiliate him again. She followed him down the long corridor, out the metal door and into the parking lot. The late afternoon sunshine always surprised him after he'd spent a day in the mall, the sharp-edged clarity of the world and the taste of the ocean in the air. Sheaves of palm leaves moved with a dry rustle. The sun was deep in the west, and the sky was shut with a smoggy golden light. Acosta followed him across the blacktop. When she saw the car, she laughed.
"Really?" she asked. "I didn't see that one coming."
He didn't look at her. His car was a bright red Prius. He'd bought it for the kid because George was worried about the penguins. They went to see the penguins almost every weekend at the aquarium. George could watch them swim all day. He opened the hatchback. The Uzi was in a black hard case. He entered the code, popped the locks, and stood back so she could have a look at it, placed neatly in its black foam cutouts. He loathed the Spanish woman and her butch haircut. And he was surprised to feel a certain pleasure anyway, letting her look it over, every piece of it oiled and black, and so clean it might have been brand new. She wasn't impressed, though. When she spoke, her voice was flat, almost disbelieving. "You leave a fully automatic Uzi in your car?"
"The firing pin is in my locker. You want it? I'll have to go back and get it."
She slammed the plastic case shut, got out her waitress check pad, and began to write once more. "Read that restraining order, Mr. Kellaway," she said, tearing off his receipt and handing it to him. "And if you don't understand any of it, have a lawyer explain it to you."
"I want to talk to my son."
"The judge will make a provision for that, I'm sure, in 15 days.
I want to call my boy and tell him I'm fine. I don't want him to be afraid."
"Neither do we. That's why you're holding a restraining order. Good afternoon, Mr. Kellaway." She took one step away with the black plastic case, and he threw the restraining order at her back, couldn't help himself. It was that last bit, the thing about how she saw her job as protecting his son from him. The papers struck her between the shoulder blades like a dart. She stiffened, stood there with her back to him. Then she gently set the case with the Uzi in it down on the asphalt. When she turned to face him, her smile was enormous. He wasn't sure what would happen if she took the handcuffs off her belt, what he would do. But instead she only bent and picked up the papers and stepped toward him. up close, when she was only an inch away. He was surprised at her mass. She had the stocky density of a middleweight. She gently tucked the papers into his shirt pocket, where they sat nestled against his multi-tool in its little leather case.
"Now, hon," she said, "you're going to want to hold on to those to show your lawyer. If you want visitation rights to see a kid, any rights to see your son at all, you're going to want to know what you're up against. You are lost in the woods, and this is the closest thing you got to a compass. Do you understand me?"
"Right."
"And you're going to want to avoid assaulting or threatening or harassing officers of the state of Florida who might lock your ass up and disgrace you in front of your colleagues and passers-by and God and everyone. You might want to avoid troubling men and women of the law who could drop in on your hearing to talk about you throwing things and showing poor control of your emotions. Do you follow me?"
"Yeah. I got it. Any other questions?"
"No,"
she said, and picked up the case with the Uzi in it, and then paused to meet his gaze.
"Yes, actually. One.
I asked you if you ever pointed a gun at your wife, and you didn't answer me."
"No, and I damn well won't."
"Okay. I was wondering something else, though."
"What?"
"You ever point a gun at your son? Tell her if she tried to take him away, you'd put his brains on the wall?"
His insides boiled with sick with acid. He wanted to throw something else. Throw something in her face, bust her lip, see some blood. He wanted to go to jail. But if she locked him up, he'd lose his rights to George forever. He didn't move. He didn't reply. It didn't seem possible that Acosta's smile could broaden any more. But it did.
"Just curious, hon.
Don't do anything that'll get you in trouble, you hear? Because as much as I don't ever want to see you again, you don't ever want to see me again, even more."
July 1, 2013. On Jim Hurst's birthday, Kellaway drove out of St. Vicente and into the smoke, with a gift for his old pal in the passenger seat. The smoke blew across the highway in a gray, eye-stinging haze, carrying the stink of a dump fire. It was kids that had done it, getting started on the July 4th celebrations a few days early, tossing black cat firecrackers at one another in some scrubland out behind their trailer park. Now there was something like 3,000 acres on fire. The Ocala National Forest was going up like a pile of straw. Jim Hurst's farmhouse was a quarter of a mile from the highway, at the end of a gravel track, crowded on either side by black mangrove and swampy ground. It was all a single story, the roof sagging in places, overgrown with moss and mildew, the gutters choked with leaves. Plastic sheeting covered half of the house where the siding had been pulled away and windows had been extracted like teeth, leaving gaping sockets behind. It had been that way for 3 years. Jim had scraped together some money to begin a remodeling project, but not enough to finish one. The lights were off and the wheelchair van wasn't there, and if Kellaway hadn't heard someone shooting out back, he might have thought no one was home. He walked around the unfinished half of the house. The big sheets of plastic flapped desultorily in the breeze. The gun went off with the steadiness of a metronome sounding 4-4 time. The shooting stopped just as he came around the corner into the backyard. Jim Hurst was in his electric wheelchair with a six-pack on the ground beside him, two cans already empty and tossed in the grass. He had the gun in his lap, a small automatic with a fancy sight, the magazine out. An AR rifle leaned against the wheelchair. Jim had a lot of guns. A lot of guns. He had a fully automatic M249 light machine gun in the garage, hidden under some floorboards below the workbench. It was identical to the one mounted on the Humvee they'd shared for 6 months in the Gulf. Kellaway wasn't in it, though, when it went over a Russian landmine that nearly tore both the vehicle and Jim Hurst in two. By then, Kellaway had been transferred to the MPs,
and the only thing that blew up on him there was his future in the army.
I didn't see the van. I thought you forgot I was coming by. Maybe went out somewhere, Kellaway said. Happy birthday to you.
Jim turned and held out his hand. Kellaway tossed him a bottle, a Bowmore single malt, aged 29 years. The scotch was a brassy, mellow gold, as if someone had found a way to distill a sunrise. Jim held it up by the neck and admired it.
Thank you, man, he said. Mary bought a lemon cake at the supermarket. Get a slice and come play with my new toy.
Lifting the pistol out of his lap, it was a gray Webleyan Scott with a laser sight like something out of a spy movie. He had a box of 95-grain Starfire rounds next to his hip, hollow points that would open like toadstools when they struck soft tissue.
Mary get you that?
That's love.
No, ma'am. I got me that. She massaged my prostate. That was what she did for me.
Is that the finger up the ass? Kellaway said, trying to mask his distaste.
She has a vibe. That and a vacuum pump on my cock. It all works out. That's love.
Especially since for her it's less like sex, more like clearing a clogged drain. He started out laughing, but it turned into a rough, rumbling cough.
Christ, this fucking smoke.
Kellaway scooped the bottle of scotch out of Jim's lap.
I'll bring us glasses.
He batted through the screen door and found Mary in the kitchen, sitting at the table. She was a thin, bony woman with deep lines around her mouth and hair that had once been a rich, glossy chestnut, but had long since faded to a shade of mouse. She was texting and didn't look up. The garbage pail was full to the brim, an adult diaper on the very top, and the room smelled of shit. Flies buzzed around both the trash and the lemon cake on the table.
I'll trade you a glass of scotch for a slice of cake.
Sold, she said. He rooted in the cupboard, came up with a few coffee cups. He poured her an inch of whiskey and set it down next to her. When he leaned forward, she saw her texting a series of hearts to someone.
Where's the van?
He asked.
It got took. What do you mean it got took?
We were 6 months behind on the payments, she said.
What about the check from the VA?
He spent it on other necessities.
What other necessities?
He's out there squeezing the trigger of one right now. The gun began to go off again. They both listened until the firing stopped. Mary said,
he'd rather finger one of those than me.
That's a lovely thought, Mary. I want to thank you for putting that image in my head.
Well, maybe if he sold one or two off, we could have windows in the living room instead of holes in the walls. That might be nice. Live in a place with windows.
He cut two slices of cake. As he did, he leaned in for another look at her phone. She didn't glance up at him, but she did turn it over so the screen was face down.
Jim already had a slice this morning. He doesn't need another.
No.
He's overweight and diabetic, and he didn't need the first slice.
She looked tired, dark rings under her eyes.
What are you doing to get around without the van?
He asked.
I got friends from work who don't mind helping out with rides.
Was that who you were texting with just now? Friend from work?
How's your kid adjusting to only seeing Dad on court-supervised visits? That must be strange for both of you, like family visits in prison.
Kellaway put a slice of cake on a plate for Jim and another on a plate for himself and went out, mugs under one arm, scotch under the other. He balanced one of the plates on Jim's left knee and took the gun away from him. Kellaway began to feed rounds into the magazine, while Jim ate cake with his fingers. Jim had been a big man, even in the army, but in those days most of it had been in his chest and shoulders. Now he was carrying it around the waist, and his fat, round face had a corrugated quality, pocked with little dimples. At the back of the yard was a splintery, tilting slat fence with targets pinned up along it. A zombie version of Barack Obama, a zombie version of Osama bin Laden, and a blown-up photograph of Dick Cheney. Politically speaking, Jim Hurst was a man who liked to spread his contempt equally among all parties.
"You bought this gun for yourself?"
Calloway said, hefting it.
"Feels like a squirt gun."